Before I get into the perfection of wisdom, I just want to thank Dharmashalin for his very kind introduction, but also Mike for talking about the Karunar appeal, this appeal where you're a community going out, knocking on people's doors, strangers' doors, asking for money for the work in India. And that is one of the reasons why we have this image of Dr. B.R. Ambedkar, Babasaheb Ambedkar, on our shrine next to the Bodhisattva of Compassion, Avalokiteshvara, next to Bhante Sangharakshita, who knew Dr. Ambedkar. We've also got a little image of Prajna Paramita there, and of course, all underneath the Buddha. Dr. Ambedkar, of course, it's the 60th anniversary of the great conversion to Buddhism in Nagpur by Dr. Ambedkar's followers, millions of people entering Buddhism as a way of liberation, the slavery of untouchability, of caste. And that's why Babasaheb Ambedkar is on the shrine. He's universally called in India a Bodhisattva. And this tremendous vision that he has of the Dharma, not just as a means of individual change and transformation, but of profound, radical social change, Dhamma revolution, as we've called it. So, you know, do really seriously think about doing a Karunar appeal, because you'll be participating in that great Dharma revolution. There are also other connections to do with the text that we're going to be looking at today. So I'll go into that as we go on, hopefully. So what I want to do now is to simply read you some of the verses from the text that we're going to go through. I can't read you all of it. We won't even have time to go systematically through the whole text. But let me just read you a few things. So open your ears, open your hearts, open your minds, and listen very carefully to this great sutra. Prajna Paramita Ratna Guna Sanchaya Gata, verses on the perfection of wisdom, which is a storehouse of jewel-like qualities. Homage to all the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. Thereupon the Lord, in order to gladden the four assemblies and to further lighten up this perfection of wisdom, taught at that time the following verses. Call forth as much as you can of love, of respect, and of faith. Remove the obstructing defilements and clear away all your taints. Listen to the perfect wisdom of the gentle Buddhas, taught for the benefit of the world, for heroic spirits intended. The rivers all in this rose apple island, which cause the flowers to grow, the fruits, the herbs and trees, they all derive from the might of the king of the Nagas, from the dragon residing in Lake Anupatapta, his magical power. Just so, whatever dharmas the Jinnah's disciples establish, whatever they teach, whatever adroitly explain, concerning the work of the holy which leads to the fullness of bliss, and also the fruit of this work, it is the Tathagata's doing. For whatever the Jinnah has taught, the guide to the Dharma, his pupils, if genuine, have well been trained in it from direct experience, derived from their training. They teach it. Their teaching stems but from the might of the Buddhas, and not from their own power. No wisdom can we get hold of, no highest perfection, no bodhisattva, no will to enlightenment either. When told of this, if not bewildered and in no way anxious, a bodhisattva courses in the well-gone's wisdom. In form, in feeling, will, perception and awareness, nowhere in them the bodhisattvas find a place to rest on. Without a home the bodhisattvas wander. Dharmas never hold them, nor do they grasp at them. The jinnah's bodhi they are bound to gain. The wanderer Srenika, in his gnosis of the truth, could find no basis, though the skandhas had not been undone. Just so the bodhisattva, when he comprehends the dharmas as he should, does not retire into blessed rest. In wisdom then he dwells. Whose is this wisdom? Whose and whence? He queries. And then he finds all these dharmas are entirely empty. Uncowed and fearless in the face of that discovery, not far from Bodhi is that Bodhi being then. Okay, I'm going to stop there before we completely do our brains in and offer something of a commentary on some of this material. And in the groups this afternoon, you can follow this material up. Somehow I'm having to do this. The sun is so strong. It's quite sort of interesting doing a sort of seminar, a talk on the perfection of wisdom and being blinded by light. I think it's quite an important symbolism here. Yes, it's obviously a message that I'm getting from that. I'm being taught something. So I want to begin by talking a bit about the sort of background, I guess, of this material and something about these opening verses. Maybe we won't even get anywhere near the perfection of wisdom this morning, or certainly before tea break. And I think that's a very, very good, very good thing. So a little bit of history. So the perfection of wisdom, the Prajnaparamita literature, is a truly stupendous literature that kind of emerged in India around about the first or second century of the common era. And it continued its production more or less till the end of Buddhism in India. You got the development of all sorts of texts, and they're usually defined in terms of the number of verses that they have. You have 8,000 lines, 25,000 lines, 100,000 lines. Then you get shorter works emerging, like the Diamond Sutra, the Heart Sutra, which is probably the best known, even down to the perfection of wisdom in a single letter. I won't tell you what the letter is. You'll have to guess. The letter that answers all questions, the syllable that answers all questions. So it's a truly stupendous literature, and enormously influential on the development of Buddhism throughout the whole of Asia. And its main topic, the main topic of the perfection of wisdom is shunyata, is emptiness, is wisdom. And basically, it tells you over and over again how basically you can't say anything about anything. This is a little bit ironic. I'm very aware of the irony here, that you have masses and massive of words which basically tells you that reality is unthinkable and not to be uttered in words. Yes, that's very interesting, isn't it, that we get all that. I think that's a sort of great danger of Buddhism generally, and particularly modern Buddhism, that you get all these words about the wordless. I think, again, there is a sort of message there. This is why you had to have people coming along like the great tantrics and Zen people, where there are no words. Like the great master, where it's more of a gesture, even a slap or a beating, if anybody tries to speak about reality. Don't worry, we don't do that in our movement. There's the famous Kun An, the great master Yun Men, a great public case, as they call it, where he gathers the monks in the assembly and he asks them a question. What are the words that go beyond the Buddhas and patriarchs? What are the words that even go beyond the enlightenment of the Buddha, the enlightenment of the great masters? And they then answer, all these monks in the assembly in this great Chan monastery in China. So he answers the question. Cake. Cake. That's the word that goes beyond Buddhas and patriarchs. And then you have an incredible commentary on why Yun Men has said cake. And the best line in it is, even the cake stuffed in doesn't stop him. So I take that to mean, and probably if there was a Zen master here, I'd get a real, you know, real thrashing for saying this. But it's as if he's saying, actually, you need to stuff cake in somebody's mouth to stop them speaking about the words that go beyond Buddhas and patriarchs. Cake. Cake. So, yes, in other words, bringing us back to experience, bringing us back to the concrete, bringing us back to the way things actually are. The trouble is, with that language, that becomes another tactic. That becomes another set of words. I'm sort of sick to death of hearing about direct experience. Can you find it tedious? The number of times you're told in words to come back to your direct experience. Even the language of direct experience is tired. Even the language of direct seeing is tired. It's boring. It doesn't mean anything. We've got to do much, much better than that. In other words, we've got to live the Dharma much more fully than we do. Really, this is what the message, the real spirit of the perfection of wisdom really is. Living the Dharma fully and completely. And you get this actually in the opening verses. This is a very, very pithy teaching. Some people believe that these, in fact, are the earliest records of the perfection of wisdom literature. They're very, very pure. They're written in a very obscure kind of Buddhist hybrid Sanskrit. It's not even proper classical Sanskrit. It's much more to do with the vernacular, much more to do with the ordinary people. It was probably an oral transmission. It's almost like notes from a particular kind of teaching, an oral transmission handed down from the Buddha. A lot of the verses in here, or many of the verses here, actually correspond to the oldest material in the Pali Canon, the section of the eights in the Sutta Nipata. There's a lot of overlap where you get this very, very pure teaching of the Buddha. Everything sort of stripped down into very pithy teachings. And the first thing we have is a context. The context is the Lord, that's the Buddha, the Bhagawan, in order to gladden the four assemblies. So let's look at this word, the four assemblies. The Chatagana probably is the Sanskrit. The four assemblies are the monks, the nuns, the lay men and the lay women. In other words, the four assemblies make up, it's the description, it's the early description of the Sangha, the spiritual community. So the Buddha is teaching the whole spiritual community. The bhikshus, that's those who've gone forth, who are men, the bhikshunis, the women who've gone forth, the upasakas and the upasikas, so-called laymen and laywomen. I don't like the word lay, it implies part-time, householder would be better. The word upasaka literally means one who sits near, one who sits near the teacher, one who is receptive to the teacher. In other words, the Buddha is talking to those who've committed themselves to the Buddhist life. He's talking to those who've gone for refuge, regardless of their particular lifestyle, whether they're full-time renunciates or people who are living in households with their families. But he's talking to those who go for refuge. He's talking to the community. So this is a very, very important detail, first of all. The perfection of wisdom teaching is not being given to all and sundry. Immediately the framework is, this is for people who've made a serious commitment to living the full Buddhist life. And this is very important, because the language of perfection of wisdom, as you probably got the impression of, no wisdom can we get hold of, no highest perfection, no bodhisattva, it's all too easy in the modern world. You get people, don't you, who like to sort of say, oh well, you know, don't be attached to Buddhism, don't be attached to your Buddhist concepts, don't be attached to labels. You know, in the perfection of wisdom it says there's no wisdom, there's no bodhisattva. You need to be beyond all that living a thoroughly worldly life while they talk like that, of course, being very, very slick with their language, they're missing the point. This only becomes real, this kind of teaching. You can only really understand it if you've really put your heart, your soul, to use non-Buddhist language, into the Dharma. You know, if you're really committed to the Dharma life, then this starts to become real. It starts to become meaningful. Also, there's a little social critique with this phrase, the four assemblies. The social critique is of caste, because, of course, in India you had this notion of four castes, which you got no choice about. You're, according to traditional Hinduism, you're born into a particular caste, and that's it. That's your fate for life. That sets your destiny. This is a critique of that. It's saying, no, it's not about, it's not about caste. That's not a society. That's not a real society. A real society is made up of people committed to higher values, and they'll either be renunciates or they'll be householders. But the important definition is the going for refuge to the higher life, the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha. And of course, our own order is based on that vision very, very strongly. Sangharakshita has this radical vision of our order, of our Sangha, that of commitment to the three jewels being primary. And the way we express that in terms of our particular living arrangements is secondary. We're primarily those who go for refuge, primarily followers of the Buddha, whether we're living, you know, full-time for the Dharma life, like, you know, and supported to work for the Dharma, like myself living here at Padmaloka, or whether, you know, we have families and a household and so on. We meet on the basis of our going for refuge. So that's the first thing. That's the frame. So we need to imagine that. The Buddha is talking to his community, to his wider community. And then he says, to gladden the four assemblies. This is rather lovely. In fact, the Sanskrit in the text is a bit stronger than gladden. It's more like really filling them with great joy, great happiness. It's a very, very strong word that's translated here as gladden. This is kind of interesting, isn't it? That we tend to think, well, if you go to the Buddha or if you go to hear a Dharma talk, you're going to get lots of sort of practical instructions that you can use and so on. In a sense, that's a bit utilitarian. That's a bit sort of, well, you know, what you can get from it. You will get a lot from it, hopefully. You would get a lot from going to the Buddha. But in a sense, that's not the main point. That's not really what the Buddha's concerned with. He wants to delight you, gladden you with the Dharma, uplift you, transport you. Sangharakshita in his commentary on this said it's a special treat. The Buddha is not doing it out of some sort of, well, I need to improve the people, you know, and give them an improving instruction. That's not really quite where the Buddha is coming from. His communication of the Dharma is coming out of his abundance of the Dharma. The Dharma is rich in him. So he wants to share it and communicate it, gladden people, please people, even if the teaching is a bit challenging. Take them, as it were, to another place. Of course, there's a lot of practical implications that will come out of that. But it's very important, this, I think, when we're communicating the Dharma, that we really gladden people, uplift people. And when we come along to hear a Dharma talk, we come with that sort of attitude. We come with an attitude of, I hope on this weekend you came not to be improved, but you came to get off on it, to be delighted. I hope so. And there was certainly that kind of feeling last night when I came into the lounge. It felt a bit like a party. I thought, blimey, you know, this is supposed to be a Dharma event, and yet everybody here looks as though they're up for a bit of a crack. Great. That should definitely be the attitude. Hopefully within that, things will filter down and there'll be real practical things that you can learn. So, and to further lighten up this perfection of wisdom. So he's taught it before, but he wants to give it more light. The word for lighten can also be translated as to fire up. So he wants to really rouse people as well. Somebody was saying to me yesterday after the introductions about an order member in his centre, who's actually moving to another centre, and he described that order member, he certainly fires us up. And I thought, well, that's a real compliment to that order member. That order member really fires us up. I was really glad to hear that. And at that time, it says the translator translates it as preached, not a very happy word. The word is basa. He just spoke, communicated this perfection of wisdom. That's what the Buddha is concerned to do. He's concerned to get in to rapport and teach this perfection of wisdom. But before doing that, he gets them into a particular mood by saying this verse: call forth as much as you can of love, of respect, and of faith. Remove the obstructing defilements and clear away all your taints. Listen to the perfect wisdom of the gentle Buddhas, taught for the benefit of the world, for heroic spirits intended. So we need to have a good look at this, because it's giving us, Edward Conza, who translates this, gives little headings to the verses, and he calls this the preliminary admonition. So this is the verse to get you, to get you really thinking about how you need to prepare to listen to the perfection of wisdom. And I'm getting a bit warm, so I need to prepare by taking my jumper off. I don't think it's just the sun. I think because it's the nature of the material. Getting a bit fired up. So call forth as much as you can of love, of respect, and of faith. It's very interesting with the perfection of wisdom that you can read many a learned book on the perfection of wisdom. There's lots of academic studies of different kind of Buddhist wisdom teachings, and lots of sort of logic and all that kind of thing. And you'd think sometimes some presentations that you need a sort of philosophy degree to read the perfection of wisdom, to read the Dharma. I'm not saying there's anything wrong with philosophy degrees and all that sort of thing, but the Buddha doesn't talk about that at all. He talks first of all about calling forth within you, calling up love, respect, and faith. This is so the first thing you need to do in order to listen to the Dharma, any Buddha's teaching actually, any Buddhist teaching, but especially the perfection of wisdom, you need to create love, respect, and faith. The Sanskrit is much more expressive of love, respect, and of faith. It's prema gaurava prasada. Prema gaurava prasada. You do find this as a set in other places. So this first word that translates love is prema. Prema. Some of you will have come across this word as a sort of generally not regarded as a sort of positive word in Buddhist texts. Prema or pema is the near enemy of metta. Have you come across that? The loving kindness that we develop to others has this sort of near enemy, which is this sort of attached sentimental love, which is called pema, like a sort of sticky affection where you stick onto one person, you sort of love them, and you convince yourself you're being really selfless and devoted and all the rest of it. But actually, you're just very attached to one person. Metta is not like that. It's this non-attached or embrace and love. But here, this is seen as a very, very positive quality. So it's the love. It's particularly, we could describe it as your devotional love for the Buddha. This is what prema is here. In modern Indian bhakti, devotional traditions, you're often asked to develop prema for the deity. For the god, this very intense single-minded love and devotion. So the Buddha is saying the first thing you need to do is to have a feeling of love for the Buddha. The Buddha isn't saying this out of some sort of, personal aggrandizement. What he's really saying is, look, if you're serious about a Dharma life, you need to get your emotions powerfully involved. You need to get your strongest emotions involved in Buddhist practice. Sangha actually, years and years ago, when he was a very, very young man touring in India, before he was even a monk, way back in the late 40s, had this crucial insight, which is an insight that doesn't need to be modified. The central issue for most of us, read all of us, in the Dharma life is to find emotional equivalence to intellectual understanding. The central issue in our lives is to find emotional equivalence to intellectual understanding. I bet everybody here knows enough Dharma to gain enlightenment now. I bet you do. I bet you know enough. You know that it's good to give up hatred and turn towards love. You know that it's good to put down craving and move towards generosity. You know it's important to be really clear and not confused and lost, and so on and so forth. Can you do it? Can you do it day in and day out? You know it's a good idea to meditate every day. Are you able to keep that up? Are you able to keep doing that? You know it's a good idea to keep the speech precepts. Can you do it when you're in difficult situations? We can't. I can't, and maybe I shouldn't project onto all of you. Why? Because my emotions are not behind my ideals. My mind, my thoughts, my ideas, my ideals, are very strong, but my emotions lag behind. So yes, we've got to be very powerfully, strongly emotionally involved in our Buddhist life. And one way of doing that is through practices like puja. It's through gazing on images of the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. Prema, in this sense, is, if you like, the emotional response to the beauty of the Dharma life, the supreme attractiveness of the Buddha, of the Dharma, of the Sangha. You just love them. You just want to really live it. There are stories of disciples of the Buddha. But basically, they started the Dharma life, they continued the Dharma life, they finished the Dharma life because they found the Buddha supremely attractive. They found the Buddha incredibly beautiful, spiritually radiant, shining through him even as a very old man. So it's very, very important to find this in our Buddhist life. Find your fundamental emotional response and really treasure it. Really hold on to it. Don't let that go. Sometimes as you get into the Dharma, as you learn more and as you meet more people and lots of things, come in and different events happen that can blow you around a bit, you can forget that initial, simple emotional response, that prema that you first had, that love that you first had for the Dharma life. Don't forget that. Go back to that. Track back to that when you lose your way, lose your perspective. Find the spiritual friends who can remind you of that original response. So important to have that, never to let go of that. And of course you can, develop it and refine it as you practice. So find that strong emotional engagement. That's the first thing you need. When the emotions are involved, our interest is involved. When we're interested, we're really open to learning. We really want to listen then to the Buddha. We want to listen to what the Buddha has said, even if it's something quite difficult that we don't understand or confuses us or even offends us. We're interested because we're emotionally connected. So find that response of prema. Really find that. But then you have this wonderful word, Gaurava. Gaurava, which is very hard to translate. Probably best translated as reverence or veneration. Gaurava comes from a root meaning weighty or heavy. You revere that which has weight for you, real dharmic weight. You look up to, you turn to, you even sort of bow to that which really has the deepest sense of meaning for you. That's who you revere. In other words, you're acknowledging that there is someone, there is something higher and greater than yourself. It's an enormous relief when you find that. It's an enormous relief. Like, oh, hooray, I am not the highest being in the universe. I am not the greatest. Hooray, what an enormous relief. And I think we also need to be really honest with ourselves about whether or not we actually feel that we are the most important element in existence. But we need to really discover, that which is greater than ourselves and serve that. Of course, this is something that happened to the Buddha himself after his enlightenment, no less. This very, very important event after the Buddha's enlightenment where he reflects that it's dukkha. It's painful. If a man has no other man to revere, to have Gaurava for, if a man has no one to serve, someone else to rely on, this is a deep sort of sense of pain and longing. This is really an amazing instant in the life of the Buddha. He's enlightened. He's liberated from conditioned existence. And yet he's reflecting how painful it is not to be able to revere and to rely and serve another man. Here I think you have a sort of real insight into the deep, if you like, spiritual culture, dharmic culture of ancient India. Ancient India, it's understood, if you really want to learn anything, whether it's something secular or dharmic or religious, whatever it might be, you need to go and find someone who you can revere and rely on and learn from and hear from. It's not about just going onto Google and tapping in something and getting some sort of answer. That really is absolutely sort of shoddy. Shoddy way of going about living a Dharma life. No, you need to revere someone. You need to find someone who you actually go and sit near, who you're actually going to be with and observe them day to day and if you like, be their disciple and they be your teacher. The Buddha actually looks around and he can't find anybody. He can't find anybody who's greater than him, but he still wants to revere. And he says this mysterious thing, I will revere and rely upon the Dharma. And he doesn't mean by that the written teaching. He's not talking about that. He's talking about the Dharma as something else, as if perhaps reality itself, or even sort of sensing that there's even more to explore and discover beyond even this enlightenment that he's realised. There's even further to go. This is unimaginable for us, because we revere and rely on the Buddha as the sort of pinnacle of things. But it seems that even the Buddha is sort of seeing beyond even that, mysteriously. Sangharakshita and Subhuti, after an interview with Sangharakshita, turned this whole event into an article called Revering and Relying upon the Dharma, which I'd strongly urge you to read and reflect upon. But we need to really think about that. You can't live a proper Buddhist life without that sense of at least being open that there is someone, there is something greater than you. And it's very important to reflect on this, because we are a profoundly democratic, profoundly egalitarian culture. It's not just a kind of social political arrangement. It's affected our consciousness quite powerfully. We have profoundly egalitarian notions within consciousness. Or even worse now, we're profoundly consumerist in our attitudes. Living a life of reverence means that you do something to your consciousness. It means that you, as it were, elect, you know, through your experience and understanding, something central to your whole life and mind. You remember the dedication ceremony? We dedicated this place as a mandala, a sacred circle, and we've placed within that, in the not just in the central place, but the elevated place within that, the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. Well, our own minds are a mandala, our own consciousness, our own life is a mandala, and we need to place in its centre, on the great cosmic mountain in the centre of the mandala. That's what the symbolism is of the mandala is. It's based on ancient Indian cosmological notions. So in the central mountain, elevated in the great palace, we need to elect the wise and glorious king of the mind, of consciousness, of life. And when that's there, everything finds its place. Then you have real harmony. And the king of the mind is not an autocrat. It's not like that. It's the wise and compassionate and glorious king that we elect. And everything then finds its place and its level. So that comes out of our reverence. You can't impose that. Nobody can impose it on you. You can't impose it on yourself. You have to discover it by developing a mind, a consciousness that's open to discovering that which is greater. That which is greater than me. Something that you can revere and bow to and serve. And of course, those who go for refuge to the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha are saying that about the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha, the three jewels. So that's reverence. And then there's faith. So call forth as much as you can of love, respect and of faith. And the word for faith is prasada. Very hard word to translate again. Prasada can be translated as faith, but it also has connotations of serenity and tranquility and peace of mind and brightness of mind and confidence. When you really do find that which you can place at the centre of your life, there's a wonderful peace and calm and confidence that comes with that. Everything is clear. This is how we need to live now. They liken it to a water purifying gem in the tradition. They say, well, our mind is like water that is very, very muddied. You know, when we don't have something central to our lives, it's like muddy water stirred up. We can't see the way. Things aren't clear. And that creates lack of confidence and tension. If you had a water purifying gem, you'd put this magic gem in the water and everything would calm down. And the water would become fresh and tranquil and reflect everything around it and be pure, fit for drinking. So it says in the same way, when we have that higher element in our life, when in Buddhist terms the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha become central, everything calms down. We're confident, we're at ease, we're at peace. We have real faith. Our mind becomes crystal clear like that water. And it's very important to, again, treasure experiences when that's happened to you. I mean, it happened to me quite early on. The first time I came along to Tri Ratna, when it wasn't Tri Ratna then, it wasn't even at a centre, it was in Brighton, in a house in Brighton where Buddhadasa, an order member, was taking classes. And I'm so thankful that my first night was a metta bhavana and, more importantly, a sevenfold puja. So it wasn't like this wonderfully ordered, you know, structure of courses that we have now, which probably would have put me off, I have to say, being impatient for the real stuff. It was a puja. And by the end of the puja, there was this tremendous feeling of serenity and joy and this sense of, I know what my life is for now. This is it. I knew I was going to be an order member. I'd only met one an hour before. But I just knew, I don't even quite know how I knew, that this was going to be my life. And there was a very, very quiet sort of confidence that went with that. That's not unusual. actually, people's initial experience can happen in all sorts of ways. It can happen through hearing a Dharma teaching, seeing a Buddha image, reading a text, meeting someone. Something happens and there's, oh, I know what life is for. Might take a while to get around to really feeling, really following it up. But it's very, very important. So faith in Buddhism is not sort of belief in a dogma. It's not that. It's this recognition that this is what life is for. Life is to practice the Dharma, to move in the direction of enlightenment. And when you recognize that from the heart, from the head too, when you get your emotions behind that, everything is clear. The way is clear. It doesn't mean it's easy. It can make actually life rather difficult and inconvenient. You know, once you've decided on that path, it can wreck everything else, which makes life difficult. But within, there is this deep, deep confidence and tranquility. So that's the first thing that the Buddha said. So really getting in touch with these emotions, these responses. This is what we need to do if we're going to approach the perfection of wisdom. We've got to be in this sort of state. Then he says, remove the obstructing defilements and clear away all your taints. So the obstructing defilements, the klesha avarana. Avarana means obstruction or veil. Defilement is, yes, a translation of klesha. Klesha means like a sort of affliction. Very interesting way of talking. Things as they are, the truth, reality, is veiled from us because of our kleshas, because of our defilements. And there's great long lists of the defilements. So there's craving, food, sex, sleep, excitement, existence, non-existence, all sorts of cravings there are. That's the fundamental one. There's different versions of hatred, ill will, jealousy, resentment, anger, rage, that lot. And then you've got all the variations on ignorance, confusion, wrong views, false thinking, intellectual confusion. We can also add in pride and conceit, jealousy, all that stuff. You can read up on the kleshas. When you've got the kleshas, you can't see things as they are. They have to be removed. They have to be purified. It's very, very important. Very important that the Buddha brings this in from another point of view, that when the kleshas, if the kleshas are there, and especially when you're listening to the perfection of wisdom, it says, if there's defilement in your mind, it's like a pot which has poison in it. So there's the Buddha, if you like, pouring the Dharma into your pot. If there's defilement in it, you turn that great teaching into poison. It can turn into something that, far from helping you to liberate, it can turn into something that keeps you more, you know, bounded by more embedded in samsara. You know, you get teachings, don't you, like, you are the Buddha already. You are enlightened. And you can get that interpreted in a very, very unhelpful way, where people say, well, I'm enlightened, I don't need to practice. My defilements are the expression of my wisdom. People really do talk like this. And thus, digging themselves deeper into the samsara. That's because people haven't cleared away their defilements before they hear the teaching. So it's very, very important to purify the heart, to purify the mind, you know, when you hear the teaching. And clear away all your taints. So yes, clear them away. So really look into yourselves this weekend. That's why before we hear a teaching of the Dharma, we meditate in the morning. We practice metta. We practice mindfulness. And in the evening we do our pujas. So that when it comes to listening to the Dharma, we're relatively purified. Hopefully it's going in a way that you're not going to sort of misinterpret it or interpret in a way that's unhelpful. When you do that, then you can really listen. Really listen. The image for listening to the Dharma is a bowl. which is the right way up, not turned up the wrong way, the right way up, that's not broken, so it can really retain what's there, and which doesn't, and which is pure, so that the Dharma can really go in, listen, really listen to the teaching of the Buddha. The word is shruta, a very important word in Buddhism. Shruta has connotations not just of opening your ears, not just, yes, of opening your heart, but you're regarding the Buddha as your teacher. And you're regarding, you're seeing the Buddha properly. You're not seeing the Buddha as just another teacher among teachers. You are definitely seeing the Buddha as enlightened. So his words have real weight for you. You're really going to pay attention. This isn't coming from any kind of ordinary source. This is coming from another dimension. This is the traditional way of talking about it. In other words, you're listening to the perfect wisdom of the gentle Buddhas. The gentle Buddhas. Actually, the word Buddhas has been added by the translator. The word is Surata. Some of you will know Surata, who lives here, an older member who lives here. Surata is actually a name, an epithet of the Buddha, and it means kind, gentle, humble, well-trained, and who doesn't compare himself with others. So it's a lovely description, is it, of the enlightened state. Kind, humble, well-trained, gentle, and there's no conceit. In other words, no comparison between self and others. So we're going to be listening to the teaching that comes from this source, from the Buddhas. And a bit more on this verse. And this teaching is taught for the benefit of the world. It's taught for the benefit and uplift of everybody in the end. This teaching is actually going to make a difference to the world. This is important. I mean, we're going to be looking, hopefully we'll get to it this weekend. We're going to be looking at teachings, and you're going to be wondering, what on earth have they got to do with the world and all the terrible things that are going on in the world at the moment and that have always gone in the world? But actually, the Buddha and the tradition are absolutely convinced if people had just a little grain of the perfection of wisdom within their consciousness, the world would be a different place. If enough people were living from the perfection of wisdom, the world would be a really different place. This is really, really important. You know, sometimes people often say, well, you know, why aren't you doing enough? Why aren't Buddhists doing enough? They should be out there, you know, eco-activists or whatever it might be, all the different things going on. If you want to work in those spheres, fine. But in some ways, that's kind of misunderstanding the power of the Dharma. If one person got the perfection of wisdom, that would make a huge difference to this world. It would make a huge difference to the way people look at the world. So it's very important to see your Dharma life as itself having a huge impact on the world around you. I firmly believe that. And I firmly believe it because I lived in India for many years. And I studied Dr. Ambedkar's life. And I looked at the effect of Dharma practice on Buddhist people, Dalit people, downtrodden people, what you can't call, but we used to call ex-untouchables, people treated extremely badly, really cast out from any kind of future. And I noticed how practicing the Dharma made a huge difference, you know, to their whole attitude and approach to life. Dr. Ambedkar said at the great conversion speech in Nagpur, we are converting to Buddhism. We are going for refuge, for self-respect. We're doing it for that. We're not doing it for material gain. We're doing it for self-respect. We're doing it for spiritual rebirth. We're doing it for our dignity. We're doing it to really stand up. And for some of many people who converted to Buddhism at the time, it made life more difficult. I met people from villages where, because they became Buddhist, they were boycotted by the rest of the village. They weren't allowed to use the village shop. They were given even more rough treatment by the local people. And I said, well, you know, but how did you feel about becoming Buddhists and then this happened? They said, oh no, we felt free. We felt full of dignity and self-respect. We felt we'd really taken hold of our lives. So that's the power of the Dharma. That's the power of the Dharma in itself. Yes, there's all sorts of ways we can improve life socially, politically, and all the rest of it. But let's not underestimate the power of the Dharma in itself, you know, for its effect. So this Dharma is taught for the benefit and uplift of the whole world. And it's for heroic spirits. It's for the shuras, as they're called. The word is shura. You need to be heroic to live the Dharma life. This is so, so important. You know, the Dharma is not for the faint-hearted. Sometimes, you know, Buddhism presents itself as very, very sort of pacific, very sort of self-accepting, all this sort of narrative, all this sort of language. You know, it fits in very well with the sort of self-help, you know, making yourself more comfortable in samsara, having a peaceful life and all the rest of it. That is a betrayal of the Dharma. It will have that effect very, very incidentally. The Dharma is for heroes. It's for people who are prepared, as Mike was saying, to face their fears. To really face themselves and to see what they really need to change, what they really need to work on, what they need to give up, what they need to move towards. That's what Buddhist training is. Sometimes when people come to Padmaloka in the ordination process, in the training for ordination, sometimes people have said to me, well, Padmaloka doesn't really suit me. I think I prefer a different kind of training context that's more tailored to my particular needs. And I'm sure, you know, Padmaloka is far from perfect. We're far from perfect here, as you've probably guessed already. We're very particular, unenlightened, ignorant individuals who are doing our best to practice the Dharma and communicate it. And so, yes, it won't suit you. Of course it won't. But since when has any Buddhist training suited any Buddhist? Have you ever found that? Have you ever found, if you look through the pages of the scriptures, you know, any training which has made people feel comfortable? I mean, imagine having Marpa, Milarepa's teacher, as a teacher, and going to him and saying, well, I don't think you're really, you know, your training isn't suitable for me. You know, I think, you know, you're bad-tempered and you're rude. You're not going to get very far, are you? Part of training as a Buddhist is actually dealing with the imperfections of other Buddhists. That's part of your training. I mean, it would be great if we were all enlightened. Actually, it wouldn't be great if we were all enlightened. I bet the Buddha was a really difficult teacher. Very, very demanding. But anyway, part of our training is dealing with the imperfections of other Buddhists. Part of our heroic quest is dealing with that, responding to that, practicing with that, learning to grow up, actually. Learning to enter into the world of maturity and being able to respond, you know, creatively to whatever arises. So this teaching is for the heroic, and you'll see that as we go on. Crikey, we haven't even gotten it. Well, we are getting near the perfection of wisdom, slowly and slowly. We've got 10 minutes before we break for tea. Are there any questions you might have before we proceed? Any things that aren't clear so far?
What would be the first experiences that gave you the impression that you were moving towards this kind of wisdom in your life?
Can you just say that a bit louder?
If you could just recall perhaps the first experience you had that gave you the impression that you were moving towards this kind of wisdom in your practice and in your life.
Right, so me personally, or speaking generally. Well, that part, I mean, there are a number of, oh gosh, there's a number of experiences. Moving towards the perfection of wisdom. Let's say, really getting me to move towards the Dharma. Crikey, in a way that it's not one thing. It's all sorts of intuitions, really. All kinds of things. I think as a child, and I don't think this is unusual, I don't think I'm unusual here, this sort of sense, hang on a minute, there's much more to this life than what's presented to me. I mean, I can remember having that feeling at quite a young age, and I suspect that that's not unusual, but it sort of gets a bit hammered out of us, I think, doesn't it? That, hold on, there's much, much more. I mean, I sort of knew very young that I wasn't going to... I sort of knew I wasn't going to get a job and you know, do all that kind of thing. I mean, partly because probably wanted to avoid all that, but I kind of knew I wasn't going to go down the tracks that were there with my parents and my sisters. But like I say, I don't think that's unusual. I think there is a sort of sense of wonder, isn't there, in childhood and youth, where you are sort of opening up to things, but it gets closed down very, very quickly by the kind of conditioning that we can be subjected to, conditioning outside, inside, expectations and all the rest of it. Very important for me in the journey was music at a young age, discovering, I mean, particularly jazz and things like that, you know, the great sort of 60s black jazz players, John Coltrane and people like that, and having these sort of ecstatic experiences. I mean, really sort of what I can see now as sort of dhyanic kind of experiences where consciousness just seemed to kind of open up, you know, through this incredibly emotional music, just, you know, just touching the heart so powerfully. That was a very important part of the journey. More sort of spontaneous, you might call them, rather pretentiously mystical experiences, kind of opening up to something sort of greater. And then that led to this sort of questing, you know, searching for, you know, for material. I mean, I happened upon Buddhist material quite early on, and just wanting to sort of... it's not that I wanted to get away from this world. It's not like that, because it's not as if I wanted to... it's almost like I wanted to see it in a different way, in that more coming out of sort of being transported by these higher and deeper experiences. In other words, another way you could look at it, experiences which couldn't just be reduced to kind of materialism, if you like. Things like that opened up. Unfortunately, I met people very early on when I was about 17 that, you know, really got me into the Dharma. And then, you know, that you know, just living, you know, for that and from that. Still a lot of growing up to do within all that, but I think that's what happened, yeah. Seeing things a bit more deeply. And then, of course, as you go on, you know, one of the things you notice, I think, as you get older, you when you look back at your life, there are experiences that you had or intuitions that you had that you didn't pay attention to at the time that had a huge effect on you. That's what I notice when I tell my life story, that every time I tell it, actually, I reclaim things that had a huge effect on me, which were actually quite unpleasant experiences at the time. Really unpleasant, but actually had an enormous amount of wisdom in them. You know, experiences where, you know, I was really shown that what Buddhist tradition calls the samsara, the unenlightened world. Listen, you think you can make it. Your Buddhism is making yourself a bit comfortable in that. No chance. You know, times of loss, of suffering, illness, that kind of thing, when you realise actually there's no security in this. And at the time it was horrible, but then looking back, actually that was formative. It's a very, very formative experience in the journey. Sometimes, I mean, this is really emphasised in the Perfection of Wisdom text called the Vajracchedika, the Diamond Sutra. Vajracchedika means the diamond cutter, the perfection of wisdom that cuts like a vajra, cuts like a diamond. You know, in a way that's bringing out these sort of how, in a way, catastrophic sort of events can really reveal wisdom. You know, when you feel well humbled by reality, where you have a kind of collision, if you like, between your desires, the way you want things to be, and reality itself. At the time, you feel a million miles from wisdom. You know, it's not this sort of blissful, ecstatic sort of moment. But actually all your illusions about life are being shattered. You know, it can happen maybe when a relationship breaks up, when there's bereavement, illness, when your ambitions are sort of defied. That's really important information about the nature of life generally. So it can come like that sometimes, the perfection of wisdom. And one of the things that we have to learn in our Buddhist training is to treasure those difficult times. Not to turn them into a sort of make a meal of it, it's so hard, it's so difficult, and that means I'm deep. You know, you get that sort of narrative, which is another tactic. But just really seeing, hey, this is what can happen in this life. This is what happens in this life. And really learning from that deeply. Yeah, so sometimes it can come as a sort of blow. I mean, I lived in India when I was in my early 20s, when we first started things in India. That was very, very formative time for me, but it was extremely difficult time for me because I was so naive going to India, helping Lokamitra start things, our Buddhist activities there. And it was the first time I got really sick. I got terribly homesick because I was in such a different culture. And also sort of realizing I was in a sense, being a young man teaching Buddhism in London, which was what I was doing before that. In a way, that was a bit of a fantasy. You know, because basically you're teaching Buddhism with, you know, more psychologically. When I was in India, for example, one of the most powerful and humiliating experiences I had was I went to the usual class that I used to lead. This was in Pune. And it was on a very important day in the sort of calendar for Buddhists in India. It was the anniversary of Dr. Ambedkar's death. And on that day, all the Buddhists and, well, even non-Buddhists who were people inspired by Dr. Ambedkar would go to this statue near the railway station to hear speeches, usually by politicians. In years later, I think I gave a talk there, but we were very, very small in those days, and we were just a small sort of group at that time. We weren't that well known in the wider sort of Maharashtra Buddhist scene. So I didn't go to that, but I went to my regular class in the evening. And as used to happen in those days, the police did a lathi charge. Lathis are these very, very heavy thick bamboo canes. And they did a charge. I don't quite know the reasons, but basically they seriously injured and killed men, women and children on that charge. That wasn't unusual for Buddhists. So people came to my class, you know, and it was a big class, probably about 50 people there, and they were really down, they were really, really sad. You know, there was a really sort of somber atmosphere. And somebody asked the question, what can metta bhavana do in relation to this? What can your metta bhavana do in relation to this? And I couldn't answer the question. I felt so out of my depth, so sort of humiliated in that situation that I said, let's just sit in silence and just be with people. I couldn't answer the question. How could I, you know, a kid from London, you know, teaching the Dharma, which was mostly sort of taken up by people who either wanted to be bliss bunnies or be relaxed, what on earth have I got to say to people in that situation? How can I give a kind of preachy lecture on what the Dharma can do? So it was a big learning for me, humiliating and sort of realising that I was right beyond and over the edge of my experience. It wasn't that we eventually in that class, we did sort of talk and we talked Dharma and we came together and I think people cared, you know, very much about the Sangha that we were creating. But that was very, very powerful. So that's a kind of learning in that. That's a learning about even the perfection of wisdom. Do you know what I mean? A learning that I didn't know, that I didn't have the answers, and that in a sense I was still pretending to be a Buddhist, if you see what I mean. This was real. This was Buddhism in relation to a real situation, practicing the Dharma in relation to, you know, the reality of people's lives. So yes, we can... It's not always about the sort of great metaphysical teachings, the way we learn about the perfection of wisdom. It can be in these sorts of humiliating life experiences.